Iran says it is opposed to a step-by-step revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. France, Italy, and several other European countries intensify their lockdowns and restrictions to fight a surge in coronavirus cases. And the UN says four of its peacekeepers have been killed and 19 others wounded in an attack in northern Mali. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iran says it is opposed to a step-by-step revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said that Tehran has repeatedly made its stance clear. He said the country's definitive policy is to have all U.S. sanctions lifted. Khatibzadeh said that only after an effective and verified removal of U.S. sanctions, Tehran would reverse its commitment to cut under the deal. The remarks came in response to recent comments by the deputy spokeswoman of the U.S. State Department. Jelena Porter said Washington was willing to negotiate the steps Iran needed to take to return to compliance under the JCPOA.
Iran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, held virtual talks on Friday to discuss the fate of the agreement. During the meeting attended by China, Russia, France, Germany, and Britain, along with Iran, the signatories agreed to hold in-person talks in Vienna on Tuesday. That will be part of the meetings of the Joint Commission of the Nuclear Deal. Later, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed there will be indirect talks with Iran in Vienna.
These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA, and the sanctions relief steps the United States would need to take in order to return to compliance.
But an informed Iranian source told Press TV that Tehran will hold no direct or indirect talks with Washington before it removes all anti-Iranian sanctions.
According to the immutable guidelines set out by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, any outcome of the joint JCPOA commission meeting, which is based on the notion of step-by-step removal of sanctions, is unacceptable. According to the guidelines by the leader, the Islamic Republic will only return to its JCPOA commitments after the removal of all U.S. sanctions and Iran's verification of the move. The Islamic Republic will not hold any mediated or unmediated talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted. Just as the U.S. left the 2015 nuclear deal without negotiations and imposed sanctions on Iran, it should now remove all sanctions without talks.
Iran signed into the 2015 nuclear deal and committed itself to limiting its civilian nuclear program in exchange for removal of all nuclear-related sanctions against the country. That was meant to ensure Iran benefits economically from the accord, but those benefits were scarce and fully evaporated after the former U.S. administration withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions against Iran. Analysts say all Iran is saying is that a once-negotiated deal does not need to be renegotiated.
The deal was the result of negotiations. So the negotiations have already taken place. The deal tells all sides what they're supposed to do. So the Americans know exactly what they're supposed to do. There's nothing to negotiate. If they want the deal to work, they have to implement it. But if they want to take bits and pieces and think that they can gain concessions from Iran, Iran is not going to do that.
Almost 3 months into the Biden administration, Washington is yet to right Donald Trump's wrongs on the nuclear deal. Tehran is clearly seeing through Washington's empty rhetoric and is calling for action. On Friday, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told a virtual meeting on the nuclear deal that the remedial measures Iran took after the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal are reversible, but only after the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions and its verification by Tehran.
The Iranian president has called on people to strictly abide by health protocols to tackle a new spike in coronavirus infections. Hassan Rouhani says a fourth wave of the disease has struck some provinces, which may grip several other areas if health protocols are not observed. He said shopping sprees in the run-up to the Persian New Year and trips during the holidays are mainly to blame for the possible nationwide surge in the pandemic. Iran has reported 123 more daily coronavirus fatalities, taking the overall tally to nearly 63,000. More than 11,000 new cases were also posted. That brings to nearly 2 million the total number of infections in the country. Bahraini have staged rallies to demand an immediate and unconditional release of all political prisoners amid the coronavirus pandemic. The demonstrations took place in the capital Manama and 18 other towns and villages across the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. Protesters carried signs reading that political prisoners are facing the threat of COVID-19 in overcrowded cells. Rights activists have also sounded the alarm that the respiratory disease is spreading among prisoners. According to the London-based Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, dozens of COVID cases have been recorded among inmates in Bahrain. Bahrain's Public Prosecution Office has announced that 126 prisoners will be freed to serve their terms outside of jails under electronic monitoring because of the pandemic. The country has registered some 150,000 infections and over 500 deaths. A number of Israeli settlers have visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque under the protection of Israeli police. That is while Israel has frequently prevented Palestinians from entering the holy site. We have discussed the matter in our news review program. Israeli settlers have forced their way into Jerusalem's Flashpoint Al-Aqsa Mosque compound to celebrate a Jewish holiday. Palestinians have condemned the move, calling it provocative. Mona Kandil has more.
Israeli settlers have escalated their daily raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds in the last couple of days during their celebrations of one of the Jewish holidays known as Passover. On Thursday alone, hundreds of Israeli settlers raided the holy site under the protection of Israeli forces, according to the Muslim religious authorities, or what's known as the Awqaf, which administrates the compound. Palestinian officials denounced what they described as provocative moves, saying that Israel has simultaneously banned Palestinian worshippers from entering the mosque.
The Israelis are accompanied and protected by soldiers and are allowed to raid the site and desecrate it. The Israeli forces closed the markets and the shops in the old town. A number of Palestinian youths were detained. It was another occupation of the Al-Aqsa complex and the old town, but this time by the settlers along with the soldiers.
Israeli settler groups have called on their supporters to converge on the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in celebration of Passover, which began on March 27 and lasts until April 3. Thousands of Israeli soldiers were deployed across Jerusalem Al-Quds to provide a protection to settlers who toured in groups the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and took photos of several places. Other strict measures have also been taken on Friday to prevent Muslims reach the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Experts believe the incursions are part of Israel's policy to Judaize the holy site and expel the Palestinians out from the holy city.
The Israeli regime is escalating the situation in Jerusalem Al-Quds. It's only mounting tensions. The Israeli prime minister is facing internal problems and he's looking for a way to survive. He knows settlers will help him to do so. That is why he won't stop their acts. Therefore, the settlers are provided with a good opportunity to desecrate the site and provoke the Palestinians during their holidays.
Since its occupation of the Palestinian lands, Israel has been launching violent crackdown on Palestinians in different ways, especially when it serves Tel Aviv's interests. During the Jewish holidays, Israeli settlers escalate their raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinians say the raids are provocative and pursue the policy of suppression by Israeli regime against the Palestinian people living in the holy city of Al-Quds. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Jafar Rahmani is a Palestinian writer and political analyst who joins us from Perth. We also have Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign who joins us from Edinburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. Mick Napier, let me first start with you. Tell us the reason why Palestinians are so outraged when it comes to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and how they are banned by Israel by going and praying in that mosque time and again.
Well, as your correspondent said, she used the word daily attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It may not be daily, but it's pretty close. The pressure is constant. And I think it comes from two sources. One is the extremist groups in the Israeli political spectrum who make no secret of the fact that they wish to take over and destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque and replace it with a so-called third temple. And they are quite prepared to pursue that agenda. It's interesting, by the way, that the Temple Mount Institute receives funding from the Israeli government to pursue this agenda, as well as from Jewish billionaires in the USA. So this is a constant pressure from that element of the Israeli political spectrum. But Netanyahu also has to worry about them, because they have allies within his government and his immediate competition. The recent elections marked a decisive shift to the Zionist right, i.e. to the elements who openly call for the expulsion of all Palestinians, every last one, and their replacement with Jewish settlers. So Netanyahu's looking over his shoulders at these people. He doesn't want to be outflanked by people who claim, as Gantz did in a previous election, that he could kill more Palestinians than Netanyahu did, or that they can be harder on Palestinians in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So it's also part of the wider picture. The Zionists make no secret of it. They wish to take over 100% of Palestine with no Palestinians, and that does not exempt the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Yeah, Jafar Ramini, when you take a look at some of the testimonies from Palestinians, you know, they're very outraged. And at the same time, they're very saddened because they can't pray at the mosque. One particular testimony that I'm reading here says that in a period of, let me make sure I have the figure right, in a period of, 120 days, was it? I don't have that. Okay, in a matter of 6 months, only a number of four or five times this particular person was able to pray there. And yet it says in this particular testimony you have settlers that go in there once in a while, you have Israeli journalists that actually go in there, you have tourists that actually can go inside the mosque, but Palestinians can't. What is the reason for this restriction that the Israeli regime places on Palestinians when it comes to the Al-Aqsa Mosque?
There is nothing for me to add to what your other guests have said, other than to change one word. It's a constant plan. It's not a program. It's a plan. It's the original plan of the Zionists to overtake Palestine, to steal our land and natural resources, and kick us out. When I was 5 years old in 1948, the message was, leave or die. The message now is kill them all. And Al-Aqsa Mosque is in their sight, and they have been doing this for years and years, especially in the last 4 years since Trump assumed power in Washington. And every single year during this time, Passover, there is a total shutdown of the entire landmass of Palestine for 10 days. The Palestinians cannot go anywhere or do anything during Passover. Al-Aqsa Mosque is one aspect of this. And shame on all the Muslim countries, especially those who hurried to normalize with Israel, that they have abandoned Al-Aqsa Mosque. But we, the Palestinians, are willing and able to defend it to up to the last man standing.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much, Jafar Ramini, Palestinian writer and political analyst from Perth. And thank you, Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign from Edinburgh. And that brings us to the end of this news review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. The UK medical regulator says that seven people have died from rare blood clots after receiving the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. 30 people in total have suffered blood clots after receiving the jab. Over 18 million doses of the vaccine have been administered in the UK. The regulator stressed that there is currently no evidence to suggest a causal link between blood clots and the jab. They added that the benefits of the Swedish-British vaccine continue to outweigh any risk. The European Medicines Agency and the World Health Organization have also declared the AstraZeneca vaccine safe. However, some countries, like Germany, have restricted the use of the vaccine to certain age groups. The company said last month that its vaccine is 79% effective in preventing COVID-19 and does not increase the risk of blood clots. Several European nations have tightened coronavirus restrictions amid worrying spikes in infections ahead of Easter. Italy has begun a strict lockdown, declaring the entire country a high-risk coronavirus red zone. New curbs have also come into force in France, where a dramatic rise in cases has overwhelmed hospitals in the capital, Paris. Other countries like Belgium and Germany have also intensified bans for Easter. It's a time when families usually hold reunions. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has urged people to limit their social contacts ahead of the break. The COVID-19 pandemic has claimed more than 2.8 million lives worldwide, with no end in sight. France is the hardest hit country in Europe, with over 4.6 million cases and more than 95,000 deaths. Our correspondent in Paris and also our correspondent in Rome joined us earlier with the latest on the coronavirus situation in the two European countries.
Well, it's the third nationwide lockdown, and the schools are closed. There is also the Easter holidays, and other measures are taken, like the limitation of 10 kilometers of movement. The figures are very, very tough. The health situation is getting almost out of control, with more than 40,000 daily new contaminations, especially due to the English variant. More than 300 deaths daily on an average base, and the hospitals are overloaded with more than 5,000 persons in emergency units. The only positive point maybe is that the vaccination campaign is accelerating.
The situation is not under control in Italy. According to the health ministry data, yesterday we had 529 new COVID-19 related deaths, and that this is bringing the national death toll to about 109,000 since the start of the pandemic in February 2020. Italy is right now under red zone restrictions, and this is going to be the case for the entire of the Easter holidays to prevent social interaction fueling contagion. The Interior Ministry has put in place measures, including an extra 70,000 police officers that will be put in the field over Easter in a move to intensify controls and checks.
Four United Nations peacekeepers have been killed in an attack on a camp in northern Mali. The UN mission said 19 others were also wounded in the attack carried out by several heavily armed terrorists on Friday. Said the attackers also suffered heavy losses. Also on Friday, three Malian soldiers were killed in another attack blamed on terrorists. Mali has been mired in violence since 2012, with Al-Qaeda and Daesh-linked groups fighting for the control of central and northern regions. The violence has remained uncontained despite military assistance from the UN. Thousands have died in the attacks, including about 230 UN peacekeepers. Rescue operations continue at the site of a deadly train crash in eastern Taiwan. Workers have begun removing parts of the train in Hualien City. The last wagon was relatively undamaged, having come to a stop outside of the tunnel where the accident happened. It was pulled down from the crash site. The more heavily damaged sections of the train are still mangled inside the tunnel. The crash occurred after the train, carrying almost 500 people, collided with a truck belonging to a construction site manager. Taiwanese prosecutors are seeking an arrest warrant for him. At least 51 people died in the accident. The crash was Taiwan's worst train accident in 7 decades. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. Having competent managers and benefiting from capacities are necessary conditions for economic blossoming.
I want to say to the Iranian nation that because of some problems in the economic situation and in the people's livelihood conditions, some individuals have used the opportunity to fabricate negative stories, saying things such as nothing can be done in any way. Some people are like this. Some individuals in cyberspace, in our press and primarily, and unfortunately in foreign propaganda networks, use the problems that the people face as a means to portray a completely dark picture of the things conveying the feeling that nothing can be done. However, I will tell you that this is not all the case. With its domestic capacities and capabilities, our economy can be one of the most prospering economies in the region and even in the world. We have many capacities. We have numerous resources, and using these resources does not require any miracle whatsoever. These are the issues which could be resolved by officials and managers with determination, a sense of responsibility, and great endeavor.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, my Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The condition for this is to have strong and anti-corruption management in the country, as well as comprehensive economic plan. If these things exist, then these capacities should be exploited. The World Bank experts are saying now, it is not what we claim, rather this is being said by well-known and first-tier economists in the world, working as experts for the World Bank, that Iran's economy is 18th among the best economies in the world. In other words, we are the 18th economy among 200 plus countries in the world, and that has been achieved despite the current sanctions and numerous problems. They say that if untapped capacities are used, later on, I will mention these capacities, Iran's economy will move up 6 spots, rising to the 12th position. This is a very important point. With an 80 plus million population, and despite all these problems that others have imposed on us, sanctions and the like, the country is thankfully alive and up and running, and it is also the 18th economy in the world. This is not a minor achievement. We should pay attention to this.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Thank you. Africa Today.
Somalia is in a protracted constitutional crisis, with opposition leaders claiming that President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, commonly known by his nickname Farmajo, has overstayed his mandate after elections failed to take place as scheduled. However, the country's foreign minister says Somalia is committed to holding free and fair elections.
It is the commitment of this government to honor this noble objective by delivering free and fair elections while continuing to safeguard the physical health and financial future of the Somali people.
Hello, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a program which gives you an in-depth analysis on events taking place in Africa. This week's edition will be focusing on Somalia's political stalemate amid frequent attacks by Al-Shabaab terrorists. We'll be asking, what's behind the delay in holding elections, and are foreign actors involved in fomenting the current crisis? In the second part of our show, we are looking into the rapid growth of African startups over the last 1 year. Now, what are the reasons for the success of these startups during the COVID-19 pandemic? Stay tuned for the answers, and don't forget to send your views as you watch our show today.
Plans to hold Somalia's 2021 general election have failed, as the ongoing power struggle between political leaders threatened to steer the country into a protracted political crisis. President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed's term officially expired on 8th of February, and now an alliance of opposition parties claims it no longer recognized the president and proposes the creation of a national council of lawmakers, opposition leaders, and members of civil society to lead the Horn of Africa nation.
It will be a transitional council chaired by one of the most senior elected politicians or politician among the other stakeholders, and that person will convene a conference between the federal member states and federal government, as well as the presidential candidates.
The crisis in Somalia is complicated by the country's unique electoral system, which is clan-based. The indirect system sees representatives from various clans across the country choose members of parliament. The president is then selected by members of parliament.
The system has been widely criticized by both ordinary citizens and the international community alike. The current political crisis comes while the country is still embroiled in conflict since 1991, when clan warlords overthrew dictator Siad Barre and then turned on each other. Since 2008, Somalia's Takfiri al-Shabaab terrorists have been fighting to overthrow the country's central government. Now, for more analysis on the current political situation in Somalia, we have contacted Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He has traveled extensively in Africa conducting field research on political economy and history. Thanks a lot, Mr. Azikiwe. Now, first, can you tell us, what's the legal status of President Farmajo after his term expired on the 8th of February?
Yeah, this is a serious question because there's a disagreement over how the elections should be conducted in Somalia. And there are political forces inside the country who are saying that his presidency is not legitimate at this point. And I think this is contributing to a lot of the instability and insecurity in Somalia. The government is fractured over how to move forward politically.
Thanks for that, Mr. Azikiwe.
In February, Somali government troops and opposition supporters, including some soldiers, exchanged gunfire in Mogadishu in street clashes that broke out during a protest march over delayed elections. What's the main reason for the delayed parliamentary and presidential elections in Somalia, and when are they likely to be held?
Yeah, this is a serious question because there's a disagreement over how the elections should be conducted in Somalia. And there are political forces inside the country who are saying that his presidency is not legitimate at this point. And I think this is contributing to a lot of the instability and insecurity in Somalia. The government is fractured over how to move forward politically.
Somalia is strategically located along the Bab el-Mandab Strait, which links the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean. Now, this fragile country is now a battleground of international and regional powers fighting for influence and the control of its resources. The Turkish government last year accused its regional rival, the United Arab Emirates, of backing terrorists in Somalia.
In a blunt statement, the Turkish Foreign Ministry accused the Emiratis of backing notorious Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Turkey is already an influential actor in Somalia. Its biggest overseas military base is in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. Speaking during the opening of the base in 2017, Hulusi Akar, the then Turkey's chief of general staff, who is currently the country's defense minister, said Somalia is a strategic country.
Somalia has strategic importance in combating terrorism and the security of sea lanes in Africa. It has a great potential to contribute on peace and stability in the continent and the Muslim world. A strong Somali army will surely take on the task for fighting terror groups nested within Africa.
Foreign countries such as Turkey, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia are reportedly interfering in Somalia's political crisis. Now, Mr. Azikiwe, is it true and what are they really pursuing?
Turkey has been involved in security consultation, military training, and economic support for Somalia for several years now. They've reached out to other African states as well. Saudi Arabia is the patron of many of the Takfiri organizations that are operating now, attempting to gain greater footholds on the African continent, particularly on the eastern coast of Africa. It's been reported in years past that a lot of the charcoal production and export is done through Saudi transport networks from the southern region of Somalia, a lot of which is controlled by Al-Shabaab. So yes, all of these countries are pursuing their own national interests in Somalia.
Now, from what Mr. Azikiwe has said, it appears that Somalia is currently not in control of its destiny. Now, while foreigners scramble for Somalia, the Al-Shabaab terrorist group continues to carry out attacks, especially in the capital, Mogadishu. Residents live in fear of imminent attacks. Now, Mr. Azikiwe, you earlier talked about Al-Shabaab attacks in Somalia's capital. How is the political stalemate in Somalia affecting the war on this Takfiri terrorist group?
Yeah, it's hampering the war because it's taking resources and it's taking the focus of the security apparatus off of trying to contain the insurgency, which has been going on for many, many years. So until they can resolve the internal political situation inside the country and also problems with contiguous states like border disputes with Kenya and other difficulties, these problems will not be resolved in Somalia. The only real hope is to build a new political dispensation inside the country that can bring in elements that have been alienated from the government for some time.
Thanks for that, Mr. Azikiwe. A new dispensation in Somalia is the key.
The Security Council announced recently it adopted a resolution reauthorizing the African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM, until 31st of December. AMISOM will maintain nearly 20,000 uniformed personnel ahead of the phased handover of responsibilities to Somali security forces. The African Union mission in Somalia is currently training Somalia National Army before withdrawing from the country. An AMISOM official here elaborates.
These are annual programs that we are implementing for our AMISOM and Somali forces that are collaborating with AMISOM in the intention that they are made ready to be handing over from AMISOM when we are transitioning.
Dardargelin fara badan inuu keeno kaas oon casharro inaan bixinno muhiim ah oon gadaal ku sii bixinno oon sii qaybinno inay suura gasho.
Mr. Azikiwe, the African Union troops are expected to complete their mission in Somalia later this year. Now, is Somalia ready to take care of its security?
No, it doesn't appear that is the case. This is something that's been discussed for several years now, and it remains to be seen if they actually pull out. because with the political stalemate that's going on right now within the federal government in Somalia, it's highly unlikely that a withdrawal of AMISOM forces at this point will result in any type of stability in the country. So we need to follow the situation very closely between now and the end of the year.
Thanks for that insight, Mr. Azikiwe. Now, here at Africa Today, we shall continue monitoring the situation in Somalia and keep you posted as it unfolds.
African startups defy pandemic.
Despite the COVID-19 outbreak, African tech startups raised a record high of $700 million from investors in 2020. Now, this is according to the African Tech Startups Funding 2020 report released by Disrupt Africa.
According to the report, 2020 was a record year for investment into the African tech startup ecosystem, with more startups raising more money from more investors than ever before. The report details how Kenya, Nigeria, South Africa, and Egypt are the premier investment destinations on the continent, though funding is also on the rise elsewhere. One of the leading startups which attracted investments last year is Nigeria's Okada e-hailing firm. The founder of the firm speaks here on his venture. Let's take a listen.
My name is Tayo. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Metro Africa Express, aka Max.ng. We run a company that provides app-based mobility to small businesses, to individuals, and to communities in cities like Lagos, Accra, and we're gradually expanding and launching other cities in West Africa. Mobility and last-mile logistics, and logistics in general, is one of the biggest challenges that Africa faces today. And at the heart of economic development and economic growth and prosperity for our people anywhere in the world is a very efficient and affordable and accessible logistics and mobility system. And how Max is bridging that gap in Africa today is, of course, by leveraging mobile technology to connect users with providers. Beyond that also, is the fact that we're taking away friction. So payments, for example, integrating with companies like Follow River allows us to take away a lot of cash-based payments, improve security, because drivers moving around with cash also makes them targets for thieves, right? So eliminating all of that is extremely important in ensuring and guaranteeing security. And last but not least, also, is a lot of the work we do around financing drivers, providing them access to credit to be able to own their own motorcycles and their vehicles over a short period of time, and also providing them training that is so important.
Now, for more analysis on the rapid rise of African startups, we have contacted Musach Obioha, the Executive Director of Ventures Platform Foundation, and Mr. Amin Yusuf, the co-founder of Afrobytes, an international tech marketplace connecting businesses and technology leaders, founders, investors, policy experts, and the media with the African tech industry. Now, thanks a lot, gentlemen, for your time. Let's start off with Mr. Obioha. Now, what's the reason behind the resounding success by African startups?
The first is, so Africa is a very large market. Beyond the size of the market, there's been a lot of underdevelopment in most of Africa, which also presents huge opportunities. Technically, if you know anything about entrepreneurs, is entrepreneurship is all about solving problems and wrapping sustainable business models around the solutions to those problems. So anywhere you see a lot of problems, the tendency is to see a lot of entrepreneurship and a lot of resilience and a lot of people trying to create innovative solutions and wrapping business models around those solutions. So for Africa, having a plethora of problems and having huge human capital, it just clearly means that there's going to be a lot of solutions coming out and people innovating and creating these types of solutions. So that's one of the reasons why there's been a boom with the innovation entrepreneurship ecosystem in Africa, and having lots of startups coming up. I think also the the availability of digital penetration through telecommunications companies also has made it possible to have information spread super fast, have communication happen super fast.
Thanks for that. Now, what makes African startups attractive to foreign investors, and what potential do they see here?
They are looking for new frontiers and new markets, and Africa looks like a very great place to be, a very great place to invest. And for them, it's not about preaching, it's more like preaching to the choir, because they already see the potential of those types of investment in their own markets. While here, for many local investors, it's quite foreign for them to understand how you could own a little amount of equity in a startup and startup can grow super fast, and then be able to exit either through an acquisition. And one of the very interesting examples is how recently Paystack exited with an acquisition from Stripe at $200 million after just about 5 years of operation. Now, a traditional investor would not be able to understand how someone can build a company in 5 years and exit at $200 million, or how today Flutterwave, which is another fintech startup in Nigeria, is also worth over $1 billion. So these are concepts that have been quite difficult for local investors to comprehend and to grasp. And that's why platforms like my platform, one of the things that we do actively is we try to get traditional investors and teach them and try to educate them on the innovation and startup ecosystem and how investment here is done and how the upsides can be incredible.
In Africa, digital innovation is transforming the agriculture by improving food production, providing agribusiness opportunities, and making agriculture attractive for young people seeking employment as well. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations is involved in a project that has developed apps for smart farming in some African countries. Let's see how one of the apps works for farmers.
In Rwanda and Senegal, the FAO has partnered with local farmers and innovators to develop and pilot four new mobile apps that are making a difference in the lives and livelihoods of farmers. The four apps have voice and text features and can be used on smart and feature phones. The first app, called Cure and Feed Your Livestock, provides farmers with real-time information and advice on animal disease control and animal feeding strategies. It includes a vaccination calendar and a list of local veterinarians and shows water points and pasture maps.
Mr. Obioha, can you elaborate on how some of these startups are having direct impact on the lives of African people?
These startups are able to create solutions that are now affecting the lives of many people, whether it's in payment or it's in healthcare. One incredible startup that I heard about recently is MDAS. They've been able to create this well-equipped medical diagnostic centers, but using refurbished equipment. But what they've also done is they're able to service multiple hospitals. So while one hospital has equipment for their own customer base, which is quite limited, what they've been able to do is aggregate a lot of hospitals to use one medical center or one diagnostic center. And what this has been able to do is it increased the number of people that can access medical diagnostic services, but also has reduced the price of those services, therefore getting in more access to more people.
Now, that's great. African startups are improving the lives of African people. That's another reason to be hopeful about Africa's future. Let's now bring in Mr. Amin Yusuf, a co-founder of Afrobytes. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Yusuf. Now, how is the increase in new business startups in Africa helping ordinary people improve their livelihoods?
I think the first sector I'm thinking about is definitely finance and access to finance, access to banking. Take the example of Kenya. They had a problem of unbanked people. And when the mobile money came, it helped a lot of people to be financially included. That means more transactions, that means more payments, that means that they had access to goods, so that was very important. And for example, now, I think that the volume of transactions in fintech in Kenya is more than 50% of the GDP. That's just really huge.
Now, what are some of the major challenges that African startups face over the past year?
Okay. So I think one of the bigger challenges that they faced wasn't even the pandemic itself, but was like the restrictions that came with the pandemic. And those more nuanced effects have affected a lot of startups. One is spending patterns of people changed because people had new priorities. So people were not buying what they used to buy before. So a lot of startups have had to try to better understand their customer base now to figure out where to pivot to. Another thing was the lockdown was really brutal on Nigeria, for one, because a lot of people lost livelihoods, a lot of businesses shut down, a lot of people lost their jobs. And so the purchasing power of many of the people reduced, which also meant that they were not able to buy the normal services that they would normally purchase, which automatically reduced the amount of money that the startups could make, which obviously affected them negatively.
Tibu Health, a Kenyan health startup, is a classic case turning threats into opportunities. This app is gaining popularity in the country's capital, Nairobi, for providing home-based medical care. Tibu app was launched nearly 1 year ago at the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic that forced many to stay at home. Let's have a look.
The age of the app means taxis and takeaways can be brought to your door at the touch of a button. But in a home in Nairobi, Natalie Maikere is requesting a different home delivery. Via Tibu's Health app, she's just ordered a doctor.
What I really like about it is it takes 15, 30 minutes. So when the first time I used it, it was for me. Normally, I never go to the hospital because it takes too much time. But this time, I didn't hesitate. I was like, oh, this is easy. I just call a doctor and it comes.
Have you ever had this headache before?
With 600 customers in Nairobi, Tibu is a small player in a global movement towards home-based medical care.
Despite the lockdown and job losses, several startups made massive profits. How was this possible?
For some businesses, it was super positive for them, especially businesses around remittances or businesses that were into foreign investments in Nigeria. So we saw some of those companies increase and grow in revenue. And by one program that we were running, the FinTech Accelerator program, we had one of the companies there that was into remittances and into international investments, and they grew from less than $10,000 in asset under management to over $2 million in about 2 to 3 months.
Well, from our conversation today, it's quite clear that Africa is a new frontier for startups. The population there is young and eager to embrace new technologies, and this creates a great opportunity for startups. That wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you, and on behalf of my colleagues here at Africa Today, it's goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. Yeah.
spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, He is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Alhamdulillah, we have been given the blessed opportunity of witnessing another month of Sha'ban, which is the month of Allah's mercy and pleasure. حَفَفْتَهُ بِالرَّحْمَةِ وَالرَّضْوَانِ. Allah has covered this month with His pleasure and mercy. I thought it might be good to have a little introduction to Munajat Sha'baniyya. And as you know, this is a very highly regarded whispered prayer that our Imams alayhimu salam used to recite. This is mentioned by several ulama in their books. For example, the late Sayyid ibn Tawus in his book Al-Iqbal, the late Allama Majlisi in his Biharul Anwar, Samahiji in As-Sahifatul Alawiyya, and of course Sheikh Abbas Al-Ghumni in his Mafatihul Janan, they all have mentioned this munajat, this whispered prayer from Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Of course, none of them has mentioned the complete chain of narration. But due to its content and due to the high regard that the ulama have always had for this munajat, so it has not been questioned or objected by any scholar. I just start reflecting quickly on some of the sentences of this munajat, hoping that inshallah we would have some opportunity in future to continue. Ilahi, a'udhu bika min ghadabik. Now that everything relies on you, I am completely dependent on you, I am in desperate situation, I am in need. So what worries me is if you get angry with me, if you are not satisfied with me, then what can I do? You need your helper, you need the one who gives you sustenance, the one who gives you refuge, to be happy with you. But if he's angry with you, if you do things that he doesn't like, if you insult him or the people who are related to him, if you declare war against him, then how can you expect help? Ilahi, a'udhu bika min ghadabik. I take refuge with you from your anger. I don't want you to be angry with me, of course, because of my own bad behavior, my own bad performance. Allah is not getting angry without reason. But if because of some of my bad actions you are angry with me, I am very worried. وَحُلُولِ سَخَطِكْ. Your anger and the settlement or permanence of your unhappiness or your anger. Sometimes anger is coming and going away quickly. But hulul sakhat means it's established, it's fixed. It's not a very quick and fast state of anger. No, sometimes you are angry, but it's not deeply settled and located in your heart. It's coming from the surface, so it can be solved quickly. But if someone has been deeply hurt,
For example, you have killed his father or mother or children and he's angry with you. This anger is very well rooted and very well established in his heart. It's very difficult to forget that anger. أعوذ بك من غضبك and also حلول سخطك. If it's established, then it's very difficult.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
إلهي إن كنت غير مستأهل لرحمتك. If I am not qualified to receive your mercy. You know, sometimes there are announcements that, for example, if you do this, we will give you something. You can bring, for example, something valuable, bring some gifts, do something good, and then we give you in return something. So there are people who qualify themselves for receiving mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They have done something good. Now, in return, Allah gives them His mercy. But maybe I have nothing to qualify me for receiving His mercy. إِلَهِ إِن كُنْتُ غَيْرَ مُسْتَأْهِلًا لِرَحْمَةٍ. I have nothing that can qualify me to receive your rahmah. Okay. So as far as I'm concerned, I don't deserve your rahmah. If you don't give me, I cannot blame you because I don't deserve. It's not that I have done something according to your declaration or according to your offer and now you have changed your mind. If that was the case, I was able to blame. But I know that I am not qualified. But still I am hopeful. Why? Because to receive your rahmah is not only coming or dependent on my qualifications. You have also qualifications. I have no qualification now, unfortunately, because I haven't done anything good to expect your rahmah. But what about you? One of your qualifications is that you can give mercy to the people who don't deserve mercy. When you created us, did we deserve anything? Did you give us existence because we deserved? Did you give us guidance because we deserved? Did you give me all these beautiful things always and necessarily because I deserve? No, most of the time you get us without us deserving. So now, even if I'm not qualified, I still hope that you give me because of your qualities. إِلَهِ إِن كُنْتُ غَيْرَ مُسْتَأْهِلٍ لِرَحْمَتِكَ فَأَنْتَ أَهْلٌ أَن تَجُودَ عَلَيَّ بِفَضْلِ سَعَتِكَ. Because of the wide and all-embracing and all-inclusive rahmah that you have, you should give me rahmah, not that I should be given. I don't have any qualification, but what about you? For someone like you, to give rahmah is natural. For someone like you, to give rahmah is expected. It's compatible with your qualities. But for me, to demand rahmah, to deserve rahmah, is not fixed. Some people may deserve, some people may not. So, if my situation is so bad that I don't deserve any rahmah, if I have not done anything to bring your rahmah towards me, so at least I know that you have such a good quality, such a good character, that you can give rahmah to the people who don't deserve. So still, the channel must remain open.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe as hard and my